I'd like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, May 2nd, 2019, and the time is 9 a.m. Present with us today is Representative Knopp, Representative LeBon, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Ortiz, and I am Co-Chair Wilson, and Representative Tilton. I think I got everybody in the room. Today we have two bills before us, SB 36, Extend Board of Nursing, and SB 37, Renewal Vaccine Assessment Program. SB 36, Extend the Board of Nursing. We have had public testimony. We have had discussion. Is there any further discussion on extending the Board of Nursing, SB 36? And I also have Co-Chair Foster with us today. Seeing no further discussion, what is the will of the committee?
Madam Co-Chair, I move SB 36-31-LS0314-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Any objections? Seeing no objection, SB 36, Extend Board of Nursing, has moved from committee. Next on our schedule is SB 37, the Renewal of Vaccine Assessment Program. We, too, have had public comment on this bill. We had great discussion. Is there further discussion on SB 37, Renewal of Vaccine Assessment Program? Seeing none, what is the will of the committee?
Madam Co-Chair, I move SB 37-31-LS0162-S from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Any objection? Seeing no objection, SB 37, Renewal of Vaccine Assessment Program, has moved from committee. Our next meeting is at 1:30. We will have the bill dealing with the Pioneer Homes. We will go through the fiscal note. Also, there were some questions last time about the difference of nursing home versus different types of care. We'll have that as well. And with that, it is 9:02 a.m., and we are adjourned. Call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, and the time is 1:45. With us today is Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Ortiz, Representative Knopp, Representative LeBond, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Foster has been excused from today's meeting. We have a quorum to do business. Before us today is HB 96, Pioneers Home and Veterans Home Rates. We didn't have an opportunity at our last hearing to go over the fiscal notes. And I believe we have Mr. Lasley online to go through the fiscal notes with us. Are you online, Mr. Lasley?
Yes, Madam Chair.
If you could please put yourself on the record and your position, please walk us through the fiscal notes.
Okay. This is Clinton Lasley, Director of Division of Alaska Pioneer Homes. Madam Chair, the fiscal note for the Pioneer Homes component is a total of $62 million. And under the governor's proposal, this year is to sort of change the way that we are operating at the Pioneer Homes in that we would ensure every elder would have a home and community to live, but return back to a needs-based system instead of the system that we have been operating under, which is where the Pioneer Homes, where the state has been funding, regardless of ability to pay, $33 million a year. And so under the governor's proposal, you will see on this fiscal note, it would be $1.5 million in federal receipts. Those receipts are for receipts that come in from our Veterans Administration for the Veterans Home in Palmer. Currently it shows 26 with the change of 5.5 under HB 96. The program receipts are receipts that come directly from elders, residents, and their families, or from their private insurance. And then the interagency receipts is shown on the fiscal note of $32 million with a reduction of 7.751 under HB 96. This would be for interagency receipts. Our interagency receipts typically have come from our Medicaid waiver program. Under the governor's proposal, we would also have a separate component, which would be the Pioneer Homes payment assistance component. And so the interagency receipts on this fiscal note would draw in for those individuals that did not have the ability to pay. We would draw down the payment assistance component and bring it in under the IA. So it would be a combination of our Medicaid waiver and our interagency. And then the final item on this fiscal note is a little over $3 million in statutory designated. Those are receipts that come in from our pharmacy. The one piece on this that I wanted to point out is the $13 million that it shows in GF. Under HB 96, let me back up. Whenever we decided to propose rates equivalent to what it costs to provide services, we looked at the report that was done by Agnew Beck, and we also looked at our current spend and what we expected our expenditures to be in FY20. And whenever I became director in September, I set an expectation that we would be at 95% occupancy. And so 95% occupancy would be 471 elders in our homes across the system. And if we divided, knowing the level of care that we currently have and those that we anticipate having in our homes, and using the rate methodology that we put forward in our rate proposal this year, HB 96 would leave us $13 million short of what we would be able to earn. So I believe in public testimony earlier in the week, there was a gentleman called in and said that the rate increase would be $78,000 for his family. And that $78,000 is actually the amount the state is currently subsidizing. And so that would be at $13,000 a month for the highest level of care we currently have. And if it costs us $13,000 to provide the service and under HB 96, the maximum we would be able to charge for that service is $10,000 a month. It leaves a $3,300 a month gap just for that one individual for that one service. And so all of those added together would be that $13 million that we would need in the GF component under this appropriation in order to fund the Pioneer Homes.
Okay, so do you have like any spreadsheet documentation to kind of back up all the stuff you just told us? Because I'm looking at the committee and we're trying to follow along, and I don't know about them, but I had a really hard time following along exactly what we were doing.
I do have a spreadsheet that was I provided it to Legislative Finance, and they may. I'm not in town right now, but we can provide that to you.
Okay, we'll have Legislative Finance up here in just a moment. We'll see if it's in our packet here. But so, if I read the fiscal note correctly, component number 2671. So the governor did not, in his 2020 budget, include any general funds toward the Pioneer Home. Is that outside of basically the $25 million that he kind of put in to help those who couldn't afford to live there?
Madam Chair, that's correct. So under the governor's proposal, it removed the $33 million in general fund and added a new component, which was a needs-based component that brought those funds over to so the only general fund within that needs-based component of the payment assistance.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you through the chair. I have a couple of questions, if that's all right. First of all, just for the record, how long has the Pioneer Home been working on restructuring how they finance the home? In other words, how long has this new proposal that you brought to us this year been in the works?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we really started looking at it this year. Over the past, say since 2015, since the downturn in the economy, you know, the legislature and the governor have asked us to look at new ways of finding revenue. And so we have transitioned general fund dollars gradually over to other funding sources, primarily through program receipts or Medicaid. And so then this year, when we really start looking at this, you know, the challenge right now that we're faced whenever we're being asked to provide the same service, but yet we have less general fund dollars, is to look at this and truly bring it back to that needs base. So, you know, if someone has $500,000 in the bank, they're getting the same, currently under the current structure, they're getting the same subsidy from the state as someone that may have $5,000 in the bank.
And second, just a follow-up here. Reason I asked that question because I seem to recall last session spending time with the previous head of the Pioneer Home where she was starting to lay out something like this. So I just wanted to ask if this is something that's been worked on over a period of time was my question.
Yes, Representative Johnson, it is. And that's why, you know, we had asked the Mental Health Trust Authority to help fund a study to really look at the Pioneer Homes and how do we best utilize the homes for the needs of the community with the increasing aging population, and then how do we fund them? And this is all part of that study. So we worked on that for a year. That came out in November of 2018. And so this is now implementing some of this. I will say that this exact approach was not in the study, but really looking at how do we best utilize the homes and how do we fund them.
Thank you, Chair. Could I go on a different tangent?
Sure.
Thank you, through the chair. So it seems some of the concerns is the mix of the population in the homes, and it's been my understanding that there has been some mission creep in the Pioneer homes from what it was to what it is now, and there's an older population that's moving in as opposed to, I can remember 20, 25 years ago, it was a sort of an active, could be considered an active retirement home. The question is because it seems that there's some concern, if we raise the rates too high, we maybe penalize part of the residents that is still more, much more that active community member who is there with a spouse who is being served at a higher level of service. And they are both able to pay through insurance, but one doesn't require that much care and the other requires a lot of care. And the fiscal question is, by raising the rates across the board, are we penalizing ourselves and actually losing enough money that we won't be able to subsidize the people in the Pioneer home? And I know that's a long way to get around to what I'm trying to say, but I'm trying to get a fiscal sense. Is there enough in the community that are paying their own way, that are at a low level of care, that they can carry some of this cost that we're incurring on a high level of care? And we should have in this fiscal in it somewhere to show the change in that population and the cost of that population. Does that make sense?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Johnson. So currently, more than 50% of our elders, just a little over 50% of our elders, are at the highest level of care, meaning that they need assistance 24 hours a day. They have, many of those have dementia. And so I believe we only have about 10% at the lowest level of care, level one. Currently, both under the proposal that the division has put forward and the current structure, elders are not asked how much they can afford to pay before they move in. It's truly done off of you put yourself on the wait list, you come into the home. Once you do come into the home, then we look and see what your resources are and what you'd be able to pay. That doesn't change under the proposal put forward. What it does is ask those that can pay, pay what they can, and the remainder would be subsidized. Again, the state of Alaska is currently subsidizing about half of the cost of providing the services in the Pioneer Home. So the state's been subsidizing about $33 million, and it's been costing us a little over $60 million to provide services. So the state's been doing that subsidy. We know with raising the rates, we will still need to do the subsidy. It's just that those individuals that can pay a little bit more would then pay what they could towards their care.
Follow-up? And I know this would only be in a snapshot in time, but do you have a percentage of the population that is currently paying their own and the percentage of the population at our current rates and a percentage of the population that is on Medicaid, strictly Medicaid and Medicare?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the number's about 50% currently at our current rates. They're paying, so 50% of the elders in our home are paying the current rates as advertised, and then the state is subsidizing half of their services. on average.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you see the governor's proposal for change having any potential to drive out a population of current payers that are paying at least some of the costs involved? And by the proposal, the net effect would be having a greater population than what we currently have that are unable to pay anything. Is that a possibility with this proposed change?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I mean, yes, I mean, anything is possible. I mean, whenever we look at this, you know, if our rates were to go into effect, they would be more equivalent to what it costs in the private sector. So currently our level one and level two is currently what you see in a typical assisted living facility or residential living facility. As you start getting into our current level three, that's where we're a hybrid between assisted and nursing. Yes, we don't provide skilled services. We don't do the feeding tubes and do things of that nature, but we allow elders to age in place through the end of life. And so, you know, anytime that there is a rate increase, whether it be 5% or 20%, we have seen a portion of individuals that decide that they don't, that particularly ones that are currently living in the homes, that don't want to stay in the Pioneer homes and choose to go into a private setting.
You good?
Sure.
So can you tell us the difference between when someone crosses over needing assisted living to needing a full-blown nursing home setting?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we typically, what we strive to do is allow elders to age in place all the way through the end of life. And so typically in many assisted living facilities, they will, if you have advanced stages of dementia, if you need a lot of assistance, you'll be asked to find another home, and then that typically that next step would be a nursing home. The unique model of the Pioneer homes is actually a cost saver to the state because we are not shifting that cost over to a nursing home facility, which would be reimbursed through reimbursed at a much higher rate. We're allowing elders to age in a place, and so the only time, and it's only happened a few times since in the 2.5 years that I've been with the division, have we ever had elders that required having to leave the Pioneer homes, and that's typically because, you know, they may have some medical issues related to cancer, or they have tube feeding that they can't manage on their own. And so that would require them to move into a skilled facility.
So there's no federal law that says that if someone needs a certain level of care, that you would have to, that's just a complete choice whether you want to be a nursing home or you want to be assisted living, but it has nothing bearing on the need of that person living there.
Madam Chair, it's typically on your medical need, and we don't, although we have nurses on staff, we do not provide skilled nursing services. If you needed skilled nursing services, you would have to go to a skilled facility.
Okay, and I have one other question. So a few years ago, I just remember a chart being given to us that there were so many level one beds, so many level two, so many level three. I think it was just three levels at that point. There wasn't five levels. And that our level three individuals were pretty much filled up, the ones who needed the most assistance. And level one, there was a lot of open beds on that. Do you still measure it that way, or do you just fill the beds at this point, no matter what level of care they come in at?
Madam Chair, we do still fill the beds. So we staff our homes based on what level of care that we anticipate in each, say, for instance, a neighborhood, all except for our Juno home. Our Juno home takes elders as the next one on the list, and they've been able to work that out. We have been transitioning and looking at how we can achieve that more in our homes. But really what we've been looking at is studying our wait list, knowing the elders that are coming in, and then setting our bed limits in our homes just because of the structure. We may be a three-story building or a five-story building. And so we set the structure in the home based on the needs of those individuals on the wait list. And so we're not holding beds, you know, like I mentioned in the beginning of my presentation. Whenever I became director, we had, let's even go back, about a year and a half before the previous director, we had a lot of beds vacant and a lot of individuals on the wait list. And we determined at that time that that is not acceptable. And so whenever I became director in September, I said, we are going to set a goal. And our goal, which is sort of an industry standard, is 95% occupancy. And we have an expectation to reach that 95% occupancy and it's in serving the elders that are in need of services.
And I'm just going to verify, you said that before those who could pay, we weren't looking at that, that basically we subsidized the entire home and nothing of that had to do with being able to pay.
So, Madam Chair, we have never, so currently and even in the future, whenever someone signs up on the wait list, we don't ask them how much they have in resources. We don't ask them whether they can pay. Well, everyone signs up to be into a Pioneer home. Once they have decided that they need to move in, they transition themselves to what we call the active list, which means that they are ready to move into a home within 30 days. We then work that active list, and then as a room becomes available or a bed becomes available, we ask the individual next on the wait list if they are interested in moving into the home within a 30-day period of time. They accept the room. They move into the home. It's at that point then we start looking at their finances, and we look at do they qualify for Medicaid? Do they need payment assistance? Can they pay what the advertised rate is? Or can they pay a portion of it? And what portion does the state need to subsidize? And so, you know, that's outlined in statute. It's very clear in AS 4755 that elders of the Pioneer that live in Alaska and want to move into a Pioneer home, we don't accept elders in based on their ability to pay, and we don't evict an elder because of the inability to pay.
Okay, so that's not what I was asking, because I'm not looking to evict any seniors out of the Pioneer home. I thought you had said that once they were in the home, once you'd gone through that process you just talked about, that we were subsidizing everyone at the same level, no matter whether or not they needed assistance or not. And so that's what I'm trying to verify.
Madam Chair, under the current system, we are, because our rates are artificially low, way below what the true cost of us providing services. So, for example, a current level three, if we're charging $6,795 a month, but the true cost of the state to provide that service is $13,333, which is what was proposed in the rate increase. The difference between the $6,795 and the $13,333 is what the state has been subsidizing regardless.
Okay, so even somebody could pay the $13,333 because they have insurance or savings or whatever it is, we've set the level so low that that's how we're subsidizing. It's not because we're not taking that into account. We just haven't been charging the actual amount necessary.
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Lassley? Okay, Representative Johnston.
Thank you, through the chair. I was wondering if the Pioneer Home, and this maybe is a big stretch, but I know other public facilities pay according to what they're able to pay. And so it's basically a sliding fee. And I'm not seriously suggesting this, but I'm wondering, was that something that was looked at?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, The payment assistance program that has been in effect for years at the Pioneer Home is basically just that. It's a sliding fee scale. So you say you determine that you cannot pay the full rate. Let's use a rate, for example. Let's use the top level at $13,333. And we determine through your finances and resources that you can pay $5,000 a month. You pay $5,000 a month. And then the state subsidizes the remainder amount. If you come in and you can pay $6,000 a month, you would pay $6,000 and the remainder. So it's a sliding fee. It's a sliding scale on the payment assistance program based on what resources you have and what monthly income you have coming in.
Follow up? So in our current sliding fee schedule, does it take into consideration the full amount that can be subsidized by either insurance or other forms of payment?
Through the chair, Representative Jones. So the payment assistance program currently would only, say for that level three that we're talking about, would only bring you up to six. We would only, because we're only charging $67.95. The subsidy amount would only go up to the $67.95, and that's where, under the administration's proposal, we're trying to correct what has been sort of a longstanding problem. And I think the regulatory process has worked. The problem has been, I think, from just with many agencies, whenever it was assumed that the state had plenty of funds, nobody really looked at these issues, right? And so now we're really having to look hard at what the issue is, and the issue is that the rates are way artificially low.
So just as a follow-up, with the new approach and the five new levels of care, you would still be using the same approach to paying those five levels of care. We have raised the funding, and so in this fiscal note, it should show the cost of either direct assistance or subsidized, well, it was basically we changed it to direct assistance, if we pass this bill, what the cost would be, because you would be charging the full amount that each patient could pay and or each patient's insurance could pay. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, under HB 96, we would fall $13 million short because we would never charge anyone the full amount of what it costs to provide the service because the max rate is $10,000 that we could charge under the bill, but our current services that we provide, the max is costing us $13,333.
But if the bill were to be changed. But if the bill were to be changed to have the sliding scale like the representative's talking about, if someone was able to do that, then that would give you that. If it was a sliding scale like we have in many parts of those based on need, why would we not do that? Why would we just stop at $10,000 if that's not the actual cost?
That's Madam Chair, that is what the governor's proposal under the administration's proposal under our current regulatory package is to do just what you said, which is to charge what the true cost of providing services are, knowing that we, under Alaska statute, have a payment assistance program that is in place. Nothing would change with that. And so an individual moving in or living in a home would pay what they were able to pay of the total cost of providing services, and the remainder would be subsidized by the state. That's currently what's done by elders in the homes. The problem is the rates have been so low that it's not reflective of the true cost of providing the service. And we're trying to correct that through regulation, which the regulation package is out for public comment at this time.
But do elders understand that, though? I mean, if I got a bill all of a sudden for $13,000, I would think I owe $13,000, and I'd probably go into shock at the same time. Versus if people understood it was a sliding scale, based on their ability to pay, and nobody, very few people would probably be paying that $13,000. Would that make a difference?
Madam Chair, it's been very difficult to communicate this. I've sent out letters. I have traveled to every home and communicated with the elders or their families. We're really not changing anything from the way we're doing business today, other than truly charging. We're proposing to charge what the true cost to provide the service. And so if an elder, let's just say within a home, whenever they move into the home or whenever they change levels of care, and so their rate would go to a different level, we would fill out the paperwork, which we currently do. We have staff in our office that fills it out. We work with the family, and we go through what resources they have and what expenses are allowable deductions under the payment assistance program. And then they receive a bill every month for that, for the portion that is deemed that they can afford to pay under the formula set in statute. And so it's been very difficult to help families understand that we're not really changing the system. We're just changing the rate to be reflective of what it costs. The system stays into place, and it protects every elder that lives in our home or wants to move into a home so that they have a home and community to live in regardless of their ability to pay.
Okay, so I'm going to try this one more time because I completely understand why they're upset. Because if the letter did not state that this would be about ability to pay and it was a sliding scale that we're going to, you know, this is a true cost, but we're going to, as always, look at your ability to pay, and therefore the bottom line, this is what you're going to owe. Did you send like individual letters so each person knew what their bill was going to be? Or did you just send out a letter and telling everybody the actual cost as if that's what they're going to have to pay?
Madam Chair, in the beginning, it was September, October, what I sent was a letter to everyone. It was a blanket letter because I don't have everyone's financial information at this time. So those individuals that are living in our home that are quote-unquote private pay today because they're paying the full amount that we've asked them to pay, that our advertised rate, they have not ever filled out this paperwork. So there's no way for me to send a letter to them stating this is what you would have to pay. We would have to go through that process with all 250 of those elders.
Well, of course you would. I mean, okay, I just do not understand how you would, I'm just going to put it out there, how you would tell people you're going to charge them this huge amount and not understand why they would be upset. You've collected the information necessary. You've already said that, so you know the ability of each one to pay. It almost sounds like you just didn't want to bother to do the work so that you could send out individual letters so that people really understood that what you said in the first place, that they probably weren't going to pay much more than they were because they couldn't afford to pay anymore. And I'm just frustrated because it sounds like we upset those in the Pioneer Home for absolutely no reason. But we also have Mr. Teal to come up and better explain this fiscal note because I'm still confused too. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Lastly, just so I understand, the fundamental principle, and aside from the bill that the administration is working off of, is to try to maximize payment of resources that are currently available without adjustment, right? Because at this age, people can't apply for long-term health care. They can't expand Medicaid benefits, et cetera. It's whatever is sort of baked in. And you're trying to maximize that point, those dollars which have not been maximized, and then subsidize the difference to the extent that they don't reach the payment schedule. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative, Mr. Kill, that is correct. We're trying to maximize and make this a true needs-based system. And for those individuals that have currently been in the home paying the private pay rate, we don't know. Until just the last couple of months, we've never asked them if they what resources they have. So,
okay.
So and yeah, we're asking individuals to pay what they can, and the remainder would be subsidized by the state.
Right.
One impact of this for the self-paying resident, and I don't know whether this matters, I'm just thinking out loud, is that it would reduce the estate they could pass through their individual wills, right? I mean, they were going to have fewer resources at the end of their lives. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that must follow. Is that right?
Yeah, Mr. Field, that is correct. So currently, if someone moved into the home and needed payment assistance, so let's just say that they couldn't pay the rates that we currently are charging, they would apply for payment assistance, which requires that you spend your resources before the state subsidizes you. The same with the Medicaid waiver program. There's resource and income limits prior to you being eligible for Medicaid, and that's why we have the information on those current individuals in the home. The individuals that are on private pay, there is no requirement today under the current statute or regulations. They just pay what we have advertised rate. And so what under the proposal is to, as you said, maximize the revenue potential coming from the elder, and then whenever they need assistance from the state, it would be a true needs-based system, and the state would subsidize the portion that is needed.
Mr. Leslie, I don't, you know, the sponsor knows so much more about this than I do, but how can the division at this point know what it can capture in this maximization effort?
Mr. Q, we don't know the exact amount right now. As I mentioned back, at the end of 2017, it was the first time we started asking every elder that moved into the home to give us some very simple resource information sheet. And then in November, I believe it was November of this last year, we asked every elder in the home to provide. So we have very limited data, you know, so we don't know exactly what additional revenue will be generated through the program receipt portion.
Okay. And my last question, Mr. Leslie, I think one of the concerns that's expressed is that, and I wouldn't know unless you had, you know, scores and hundreds of people on your waiting list who were solvent, whether you're chasing off paying customers who will start to look elsewhere and separate themselves from their Alaska families, maybe out of fear that isn't based in the logic of what you're trying to do, but maybe, I don't know. I don't know how much you can replace of the income you have now if they decide to look at the competitive marketplace. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You know, from the limited data that we had, there was an estimate of about $5.7 million as the additional funds that would be generated through this effort. You're correct. I mean, there's no way of knowing whether elders would decide to move into the private marketplace or stay at a Pioneer home.
Well, I just was dishonest with the chair. I said I didn't have another question. Can I have one more?
I'm simply shocked. Representative Josephson.
I mean, through the chair, I guess the one thought that comes to mind is if it's $5.7 million, why not just raise the rate to that level?
You know, I think what we were trying to accomplish here is to just truly get the rates what the true cost is, because, you know, we keep hearing, you know, in the last few legislative sessions, we've been asked, you know, to find ways to earn more money. But the challenge is we're never charging what it truly costs to provide the service. So individuals think that they're paying the full amount. And so if you tell them to pay $5,000, they're going to pay $5,000. And so what the effort here was more to be truthful and honest. This is truly what it costs us to provide the service, and then make it go back to this being a true needs-based system, and those individuals or anyone that needs assistance would receive the assistance they need, as is designed with the payment assistance program or any other subsidy program. It's based on what you truly need, not based off of an arbitrary number that we're just subsidizing everyone.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lastly, thank you. And please do not, this is not an attempt to be cynical, but how are we going to address the problem of fraud? For example, an individual transferring assets to another family member to avoid the appearance of, more assets in their portfolio. I like to think we can operate in an honor system, but I know that there are people that try to take advantage of the system. So have you looked at addressing that?
Through the chair, Representative, under the payment assistance program that currently requires a three-year look back, which is the program that's been set up for many years. Medicaid requires a five-year look back, but under state statute and regulation, it requires a three-year look back.
Follow-up, thank you. So when you say a three-year look back, is that a look back at income or a look back at assets?
Through the chair, it is a look back at both income and assets. So we require bank statements. We have to show, they have to show what if they owned a home or had any other non-liquid assets, and then we were able to do title searches and do things of that nature.
Fantastic, thank you.
So you have to have a four-year look back, maybe. Representative Ortiz.
Not right.
Good. So I'm going to, before we ask Mr. Teal to come up, I'm going to have Representative Fields come up and maybe remind us exactly what this bill does and what you're trying to accomplish. Make sure we're not kind of getting lost inside of the fiscal notes.
Sure. For the record, Zach Fields. The purpose of this bill is to honor the historic commitment of the state of Alaska to the Pioneer Homes, respecting our elders, and also provide as solid a financial base for the homes as possible. And I think there's basically a disagreement about what's the best economic policy for these homes and what is a competitive environment. And my concern, I studied economics, my concern is that by setting a price point that is impossibly high, you're gonna scare off paying customers, adversely impact the pool of Pioneer Home residents, and ultimately cost the state more money. And that you can set this artificially high price point, I mean artificial in terms of the market, not the cost of care, but actually collect less revenue. And I guess I would just suggest hearing from Ledge Finance about that, since they're kind of an impartial arbiter. But my goal is that the Pioneer Homes be as financially sound as possible for another 100 years.
So I know what your goal is, but specifically, what are you doing? Are you setting the rate in statute?
I'm capping the rates to which the department may raise. And I would prefer not to have to do that in statute, but given this proposal that I think presents very serious concerns about long-term financial viability of the homes, unfortunately I felt it was necessary to cap the extent to which the department could raise the rates. And then in out years, so that we don't lose ground as we did over the last 15 years, it provides the department the ability to raise rates based on the Social Security rate of inflation without going through the more onerous regulatory process, so that we can better keep pace with increasing costs of care and not fall into a hole like we did last time.
So if I understand you correctly, so on page 3, section 5, you have the different rates for housing, meals. Could you just explain to me, so sure. I'm talking about section 5F, and the amounts that you have here. So I'm assuming that that's based on the five tiers. Is that where we're getting?
Yes, and
31.
Yes, and my bill does accommodate the in the department's desire, as recommended by the Agnew-Beck report, going back to the Senate Bill 74 recommendations, to go from 3 to 5 levels of care. And those are the levels that you see there. You see that there is not, if you look at Section 5, Subsection F, Subsection 5, there is one category for which I don't cap rates, and that is that Tier 5 complex behavioral health issues, which is a separate rate of reimbursement. And, you know, that's really a separate population. Those would be residents of the behavioral health neighborhoods. It is not necessary, in my view, to cap those rates. In terms of the Pioneer Homes being competitive, it is necessary to limit the rate increases proposed by the department for levels 1 through 4, which are more of what we think of as the traditional Pioneer Home population.
So your levels, because you don't say what level they are, basically the level, though, is because you have outlined very specifically, like in the 3100, that it's housing, meals, emergency assistance, and recreation. Then if I go number two, now I've added intermittent assistance with activities of daily living. And it's, I'm assuming that that's basically how the Pioneer Home does it now, when they see where you fit in, and that's where it comes into?
That's correct. The language here corresponds to the description of the levels of care.
Okay, and so number 5 on page 4, so this would be your highest level of care. You're not setting that in statute, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so then can you tell me now, number, so we have more things. We have 6 and 7. Can you tell me what these two, because we've got the 5 levels of care, so 1 through 5. So 6 and 7 is supposed to be for whom?
I'm going to defer to my staff person, Tristan Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff rep Fields. If you look at page 4, line 8 and line 13, those are payment schedules for respite care. So those are additional services that are currently set in regulations. They are not set in statute. And since we are transferring this schedule into statute, we worked with Ledge Legal to make sure that these were also reflected there.
And respite care is for care would be in somebody's home, not in the Pioneer Home.
Through the chair, Representative Chairwoman Wilson, they are available for residents in the Pioneer Home, and I would defer to Director Lasley to the extent to which they're used.
So Mr. Lasley, I'm just trying to find out on page 4, we're on number 6, which is lines 8 through 12, and number 7, lines 13 through 16. On the respite care, is this how much that someone pays in addition to the rates that they have for the care that they currently have?
No, Madam Chair, that is set currently in regulation. That is to allow us to provide temporary services up to 14 days for an individual that needed to come into a home. It could be for someone that has been cared for by a family member at home, but for whatever reason cannot be temporarily cared for. Could be for a primary care provider that is taking care of an elder at home and needs to leave town for a couple of weeks. They could come into one of our homes, and this would be the daily rate to provide, get those services.
Okay, so the $70 is for, it's not capped as far as how many days. It's 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., but the $100 a day would be basically somebody living there, because it says 24-hour day for 14 consecutive days. And is this $70 and this $100 pretty reflective of what the actual cost is right now?
Madam Chair, this is reflective of what is currently in regulation. In the division's regulation package, we had increased those rates.
To what?
To be reflective of a daily. Looking here.
Obviously, it's a really big regulation.
I apologize. apologize.
Well, if you can't find it, you can get it to us. You know, we're just trying to figure out, you know, how if part of it is trying to make sure that we're keeping up on cost. I would just be curious whether or not it's somewhere close or this is just half of whatever it is. I'm sure the representative would like to know as well. But we have some other questions. Representative Merrick? Go ahead, Mr. Lastly.
Madam Chair, so the $70 rate would change to $161, and the respite service would change to $322 because it's 24-hour daycare.
That sounds probably more reflective of what the actual cost would be. Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a certain number of beds allocated for respite services?
Through the chair, we don't leave beds vacant. Typically, just through vacancy rate, we would have a space available if someone needed to come into a home. We haven't used the service a lot. We haven't been asked to use it, but we did want to keep that ability to provide the service if someone needed it.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I can't remember where, but I recall hearing that the rates you've recommended are actually higher than the inflation adjustment would have been since they were last adjusted. Is that possible?
They actually are a little higher, and I would, you know, this bill has been through State Affairs, Health and Social Services, and now Finance, and we've heard from different committee members and the public, and based on public input, I think Abe Thompson provided compelling testimony, Rocky Plotnick, a lot of these are, you know, married couples where one person is living independently outside the home, one person is in the home. Based on that public testimony and the multiple additional committee discussions, I would be supportive of ratcheting that increase back down a little bit, particularly in light of recent conversations with Legislative Finance about kind of the economics of revenue capture and how we best provide sound financial footing for the Pioneer Homes.
Thank you.
Sounds like the representative is at disadvantage with not being able to see all the financials. Any questions? Representative Ortiz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Merrick asked one of my questions about whether there's a regular set aside of rooms. And the answer, I think, was no. And in fact, my question would be, are most of the homes, do they have a pretty substantial waiting list to get into the homes?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, so there is a wait list in every home. Currently, we have system-wide about 200 individuals waiting to move in. Again, we set an expectation to be at 95% occupancy. And so that would always, just through the natural flow of individuals moving in and those that died, that we always have a set number of rooms typically available.
Follow-up?
So those are the rooms that would be used for that.
And on the subject of waiting lists, can you tell me the current process of how that waiting list is cleared? Is it purely a first-come, first-serve basis? What's your selection process?
So, through the chair, Representative, currently, anyone that is age 65 or older may put them and has lived in the state for more than a year can put themselves on what is called the inactive wait list. That means that they're setting their place basically in line, because we do our wait list for activation based on the original application date. And so anyone 65 and older can put themselves on the inactive wait list. Then once they become, an individual decides that they're ready to move into a Pioneer home, they activate themselves, so they just transfer themselves over to the active wait list, and they can select multiple homes that they're interested in moving into or one specific home. And then from that point, as a room or bed becomes available, we start working down that wait list, and it goes off of the original application date. And so we look at the level of service that's needed, and we start making calls and offering rooms.
Thank you.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you. And a follow-up to Representative Ortiz's question about the wait list. So there's really two wait lists. One is an inactive one, where I, as a, say I moved up to Alaska last year, and since I'm turning 65 in July, I could sign up for that inactive list. And then as, and that just goes number of years, it becomes weighted by how many years on that you're on that list. And then as you need or as you want to get into the facility, then you become an active list. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then that active list is weighted by the number of years I was on the earlier list. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
So, and I guess this is through the chair where my only concern, and it isn't a large concern, but the mission creep, the Pioneers Home, was a home for people that worked, basically built Alaska or were part of Alaska history. But like a lot of our efforts to sort of honor participating in the community, we were not constitutionally legal, and we had to open it up to anybody that had been here for a year. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. We do, though, still see, because of the waitlist system, that individuals coming into the home have been in Alaska a substantial amount of time. And again, you touched on something earlier, and then just again, Representative Johnson, that is that, you know, we're seeing individuals' average age in our home currently is 87. And so elders are not coming into the home at a young age anymore. We encourage everyone to get on the wait list at 65 so they do set their sort of their place next in line. But elders are coming in and are able to live in the community and in their homes until a much later point in life, and that's coming in when they truly need high levels of services.
Thank you. As a follow-up, so there's actually the mission of the home has changed drastically probably in the last 10 years, 20 years. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that is correct. We used to have a lot of individuals at the level one and level two. Now more than 50% of our elders are at the level three, which is our current highest level of care. And more individuals are coming in at that highest level of care.
Thank you.
Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm 66 and I move to Alaska and I meet the one-year residency requirement, could I skip the first list and go straight to the second list and then start to build my time in on the second list and make myself available to move in as soon as possible? And then if I'm on that list, the second list, do I have priority on that list because I'm now on that list from, say, someone who has been in Alaska for 65 years and has now added their name to the list and wants to be treated more special than I?
Through the chair, Representative, there's two parts to that. The first part is, yes, if you have lived in the state for 1 year, you can put yourself on the inactive list, and then the next month you could put yourself on the active list. That is what is required under statute. But having said that, because we maintain a wait list of active and inactive individuals, if you came on to, using your analogy, someone that just came into the state, or let's just say that their application date was 2018, they get themselves on the active list, and there's three individuals in front of them to move into that specific home. Next month, there may be seven individuals in front of them because four new individuals may have activated themselves with a much earlier original application date. So the the earlier you apply, the better placement you have on the wait list, and it will continue to drive those individuals that have just recently gotten onto the wait list. They tend to drive down because there's always individuals activating every month.
Yeah, well, that answers my question, that I'm not rewarded because necessarily I'm available immediately to move in, even though I've only been here 1 year. There's still a benefit for being on list number one for 14 years and then putting yourself on list number two. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Okay, so you know, other questions right now. We're going to have Mr. Teal come up and explain the fiscal note, see if we get the same ideas we got before. And Representative Fields, if you ever feel like you need a way in, please feel free to stay at the table if you would like. I know sometimes it's really hard to sit in that back seat. Been there, done that. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. And unfortunately, this is not a simple walkthrough of the numbers in a fiscal note. I think the questions by the committee demonstrate that you understand some of the behavioral implications and other things that are built into these notes that make them not merely a numbers exercise. And that said, in public testimony, one of the people said that the bill changes the source of funds to operate the Pioneers Homes, but it doesn't change the amount required to operate them. I think that's a key point, that you're still operating a Pioneers Homes system, and that part of the problem with these fiscal notes, a complicating factor, is the change in structure. You now have a payment assistance thing, and that makes it appear that the fiscal notes reduced by $33 million to operate Pioneers Homes, but then there's another $20 million added back over here, and then there's interagency receipts and other things that I think it's easier if you just try to envision the homes as a single appropriation. And what you have there is a governor's proposal that reduces costs, general fund costs, by about $12.3 million. And the problem with that is that, as you just heard testimony, they don't really expect to recover the receipts. In the budget, it makes it appear that the 12.3 of missing UGF will be replaced by Medicaid receipts and by program receipts, rent payments from the people that occupy the rooms. But you just heard today that they don't really expect to collect more than 5.7. When we did the fiscal note, we were looking at kind of lucky to get 5, just guessing at some of the numbers. So we looked at it as the budget, the governor's budget, leaves the Pioneers Homes short by $6 to $7 million. That said, the implication is that you can expect a supplemental request for, call it $7 million next year, to run the homes. In other words, the governor's budget underfunds the homes relative to 19. Total cost shouldn't change, but he's doing some fund source changes here and replacing the general funds with what we consider to be uncollectible receipts. Now, it looks to us like under the governor's budget, the Pioneers Homes would run out of money in May sometime. We know that HB 96 proposes lower rates than the governor. The implication there is that you would collect less in receipts than the governor did, and therefore you'd have an earlier date that you would run out of money. But we don't necessarily see it that way. It's it's much easier, in my opinion, if you stop trying to compare the fiscal note to the governor's budget, which is the way fiscal notes need to be prepared. And if you think of it this way, then we believe that HB 96 will reduce costs by about $2 million from FY19. And that looks a lot less than the governor's reduction of $12 to $13 million. But remember that we're comparing to a governor's scenario that hasn't yet occurred and that is not fully funded. So it makes all your comparisons really difficult to make. Now, I think your questions, Representative Johnston, Ortez, Josephson, all were asking questions about how this affects behavior. That was our primary concern in looking at the fiscal note, because we were concerned that raising the rates, particularly at level one, would drive people out of the homes. Now, if they're driven out of the home to be replaced by someone that requires more extensive and more expensive care, the governor's bill could cost more than HB 96. Exactly how to quantify that was difficult, but we see it as a real concern. In fact, if you look at the spreadsheet that was handed out, I think during the last discussion, did members get that? This was prepared by the director of Pioneers Homes. And was that handed out?
Let's do a brief at ease and make sure everybody has a copy of that. Everyone now has the chart that we were talking about. So, Mr. Teel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this answers some of the questions you were asking. The furthest left column, actually second from the left, shows you the number of people at each level of care. That's important because you can see that over half of the people are at level four care, as Director Lasley testified, and that we know that 20 years ago, many of the occupants were at level one care. It was essentially a condo project for people over 65, and the importance of that shift in who occupies the homes is in the furthest column to the right. And you can see there the subsidy involved, total line $13 million. That's how much is in the fiscal note to get back to full funding, because under HB 96, rates would go up less than the governor's by $13 million. And so this, the fiscal note requests $13 million to get back up to the full operating costs. The governor did not request that money, and his budget would be short. So that makes the comparisons very difficult to make. But again, what you've got here is something that says your rate would be $3,100 at level one care. Now, it leads to this really awkward position. It sounds like you're being hard-hearted and mean to seniors, whatever. But if you're just interested in the money, and this is what three representatives were getting at, then you should be lowering rates at the Pioneers Home, not raising them. Because you have increased the rates of level one care to the point that people don't go in there at level one. Because if it's going to cost you over $3,000 and you're functioning just fine on your own, why go to a Pioneer's home anymore? It's way more expensive than staying in your home. So if you make those low tier, the relatively cheap rates lower, then let's take this as a true cost of providing level one care. It's in monthly occupied bed rate in the fourth column from the left, $3,600. That's what the governor would charge. And you say, well, let's just charge $2,000 a month instead. You could say, well, then we're subsidizing all those people by $1,600 a month. That's expensive. But if that room is occupied by someone where you've got a $1,600 a month subsidy, but they occupy the room, making it so that someone at level four won't be admitted, and they're the ones at high levels of care, but instead of subsidizing at $1,600 a month, you'd now be perhaps subsidizing someone at the rate of $15,000 a month. So you're really asking the preparers of fiscal notes to project behavior here, economic alternatives. There's no way that we can take the information that we have, which does not include information about occupants' finances, the impact of rate increases on the number, and the requirements of future occupants, and come up with a fiscal note that we can say, pretty good numbers here, reasonable, you should believe them. All we can say is that HB 96, to us, looks like it would reduce costs from FY19. By about $2 million. The governor would reduce it, proposal, would reduce it by more than that, but because of the higher rate increases, could actually cost more than HB 96. And, you know, exactly what happens is unpredictable. So the thing that's important, another thing about the HB 96 fiscal note, is that there's a request in there for $13 million that you see. Well, there's nothing in the bill that requires a $13 million increase in general funds. That's simply the cost to run the homes as they're being run now. And that's, again, relative to the governor's budget, where he's taking that general funds away and underfunding the programs. And the fiscal note keeps them operating with enough money to run it for a full year. So, again, the numbers in the fiscal note are hard to put together, and I can see why everybody's been going, I just don't understand the fiscal notes, because they're difficult to understand, difficult to prepare, and we think the fiscal note that was prepared for 96 is reasonable, but understand that it fully funds the home for a year, and that's why you see that big increase in general funds.
Representative Johnston.
Thank you, through the chair. While I very much agree with you that we, none of us have a crystal ball on this, and we struggled with this in finance subcommittee and ultimately ended up subsidizing UGF more than the governor had asked for. But one aspect of this that we're not talking about, and it's probably a really hard one to discuss, is what the policy is to capture as much available funds as possible, and particularly to capture the funds as you get up to level 4 and 5. And we are not capturing the Medicaid funds currently at those high level of cares as much as we could be. The difficult discussion here is you can have residents who have gone into the facility with funds of their own and with assets, and they can fund themselves up to a point, but then it becomes a negotiation with Medicaid as far as when their fees will be subsidized, and sometimes that means a divestiture of their assets. So we're, you know, I would say, and you know, I'd like your input on this, the discussion is as much about how much the subsidy is to the Pioneer Home, what is the population of the Pioneer Home, and are we subsidizing, it's not just residents, but could we be even looking at this as subsidizing their estates?
Through the chair, those are all good questions, and I think you know the answer, you just can't quantify it. Neither can I, because we know that the governor's proposal will take more money from certain residents. If you are a self-pay, it's going to cost you more, in theory, because all the rates are up. It may be that you're just right on the edge, and that if they raise the rates $100, you get off of completely self-paying, and now you're partly subsidized. But without access to all the financial records of the individuals, and even then you'd say, well, that's what's happening today. What's happening a year from now? We have no idea. So, without knowing who's going to be admitted, what level of care they are, you just don't have a fiscal note. But subsidizing estates has to happen unless you're taking all the full cost. And, you know, I don't know how big a problem it is, because I don't know how many people can be self-paying when the cost is $15,000 a month. It's just you need way more information than is available or could possibly be made available. So you just kind of have to guess at this, and that's why I say, well, simplify it, compare it to 19. HB 96, in our opinion, looks like it will run about $2 million cheaper than the current system. The governor's proposal may run it even cheaper than that, but as you get higher and higher rates, you drive self-pays out and potentially replace them with completely subsidized people. Unless you can tell me who's going to be in those homes, I cannot give you an accurate fiscal note.
Representative Sullivan-Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at the spreadsheet that we have before us, I guess I'm just really curious, as the budget that we had worked on previously truly wasn't the governor's budget from February 20. It was the budget previous to that. So I'm not quite sure that we're getting the accurate numbers that we should be working from. And I'm wondering if we could get another comparison, if you will, with regard to the budget that actually came before us, as well as in comparison with the budget action items that had gone through the process through HESS.
Through the chair, that makes perfect sense. Unfortunately, fiscal notes are prepared to the governor's original budget. The departments say that we can't possibly keep up and prepare fiscal notes for the House budget as it passes, and then the Senate budget. We don't know what any legislative action is going to do. All fiscal notes are prepared relative to the governor's budget.
Correct. Follow-up. However, using the FY19 adjusted base budget was what we were using. So wouldn't you do the comparison from that? And we get updated fiscal notes all the time.
Again, through the chair, you get updated fiscal notes, but generally speaking, the base, the governor's budget, isn't changing. The fiscal notes are updated because the costs change, not the base changing. And in this case, you're absolutely right. The governor came in with an amendment for $5 million more in general funds, recognizing that the 12.3 shortage in general funds could not be made up by receipts collected from residents. So I think the original budget would have left you shorter than the 12.3, if the 12.3
is that right?
It would have been 18, so we are actually comparing it to the governor's amended budget. And again, the question is, you just heard testimony that said, we think we can collect $5.7 million from the residents or from Medicaid, but the shortage was 17.3 and is now down to 12.3. So you're still short $6.5 to $7 million in the governor's amended budget.
Madam Chairwoman, could I try to answer that slightly different way?
So just 1 second, so I just want to make sure we understand. So with what the point that Representative Sullivan-Leonard is bringing up, and I appreciate that, but I just want to make sure we verify ourselves. So although the governor's budget had zero under general funds, so let's say when the process gets done on the FY20 budget and between the House and the Senate, we end up adding, let's just say, $15 million of general funds just that would go into this blank. Would we still add another $13 million because of this fiscal note? Or would someone take into account that the original governor's bill, the one that he filed in February, had a zero? The 15 can now cover this $13 million. Does that happen, or is this an additional $13 million Pioneer Homes, no matter what happens out of conference committee?
Madam Chair, the $13 million would be additional money added to the House, Senate, Conference Committee budget, whatever you want to call it. And remember, though, that in the payment system, there's a negative $2 million. So really, it's an $11 million net add. And that net add would bring the Pioneers Homes appropriation up to the full cost of running the home.
Unless we already put money in, unless in the conference committee more money is added. So would you have to state on this fiscal note that we would only be adding this $13 million with the assumption that the line stays at zero?
Again, the House added 10. The governor added 5 in amendments. The Senate went with the governor's number. The House added an additional 5. So if the conference committee went with the House number, then this fiscal note should be reduced by $5 million. That would occur in conference committee.
Okay, so that's where our fiscal notes would. I mean, it's a great question because we did the budget off as a budget we already had, but yet because that is still going through the process for FY20, you can't count the House nor what the Senate did until the final numbers. So the only thing that we know for current FY20 is the governor's budget, which is reflected. So if anybody out there is watching our presentation, if you were to pull it up, there is a column that says included in governor's FY2020 request. And then the first column is FY2020 appropriation requested. And so now it's my understanding, just to make sure that the $13 million we have, which would actually be $11 million because we have a second fiscal note that decreases that by $2 million. If we end up at conference committee, which is comparing the Senate and the House budgets together, that amount of money would then be deducted if we're trying to go all the way with this budget to reflect making sure that we are fully funding the Pioneer Home.
Correct. And under HB 96, the cost would be roughly $2 million less than in 19.
And one last question for me. So on this, because it's my understanding that Representative Fields is trying to set the fees, you know, based on what individuals are at. As you said, Mr. Teal, we don't know what that is at this point. So this $13 million is really not reflective of what exactly needs to be done because we don't know what level of care each one is in. So we're not really just supplementing somebody's rent. We are just as a home, the entirety of the home, because we're just doing our best guess at this point of what it might take to make sure that we cover all of our costs.
Madam Chair, correct to a large extent, but if you look at that spreadsheet, it will show you where the subsidies occur. That far right column, that's the $13 million, 10 of that is at level 4. And so that you can see a little bit about who's in there and what level of care receives the most subsidy. It's not done on a per person, but I'm not sure that it really breaks down that way.
But isn't our deficit actually larger than that here because the 12 individuals that are level 5 are not reflected?
Correct. And, you know, all I can say here is this is probably about the messiest fiscal note you'll ever see. So that's good news, I think, because but for this bill, through no fault of the bill or the sponsor or anything, it's just you're trying to compare to a budget that doesn't fully fund the program and getting a fully funded fiscal note, and you're trying to predict behavior, which is virtually impossible to do.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been listening for a couple days now worth of discussion on the Pioneer Homes, and I'm not sure that I really understand our purpose with the Pioneer Homes, whether we really understand our purpose. If our purpose is to take care of all of the elderly with the Pioneer Homes, with the number of beds that we have, then that purpose is going to cost X number of dollars. And so whether the state subsidizes or whether the people, the residents, pay their up to, you know, it's needs-based, then the question before us is not anything other than where are we getting the money, if that's the purpose. So I would go back to the original service that was, and ask the question, was the original service, original intent of the Pioneer Homes ever to be anything more than a level one care? Is that accurate?
Representative Field, do you know the answer to that question? I do not.
And I have a follow-up.
Through the chair, I think I can attempt to answer that. When the homes were established, well, the first home in 1913, it was established as a home for indigent men. So I think the changing population is actually more reflective of demographic change within the population writ large rather than a direction that the department took consciously. So it just so happened that, you know, 50, 70 years ago, people died younger. They, frankly, they didn't live long enough for the population of the Pioneer Home to be 50% people living with some form of dementia. So as people live longer, we are actually meeting the original purpose of the Pioneer Homes, which is to take care of people in their final home. But as people live longer, it just so happens that more Alaskans who are in this final home have dementia, therefore cost more money. So I think we are actually meeting the original mission of the home, but we're doing that in an environment where the demographics have changed pretty significantly.
Representative Carpenter.
As a follow-up, because it really does go down to the question of purpose. And a further question for us is, at large, is really policy-based, and it's, are we willing to subsidize any amount to be all things to all people? If our levels of care here, 1 through 5, cover all possible care for any possible elderly person that would come into the 471 beds that we have available, and then we've got a waiting list for a bunch more. So if that represents all things to all people, is that something that we're going to subsidize and pay for? Is that what the intent of the Pioneer Homes are for our state and our society, to be all things to all people?
That's a policy call that will be made, not just by this committee, but by the representative. Representative Fields.
Sure, Madam Chair, and through the chair, I don't think that the purpose of the Pioneer Homes is or has been to be all things to all people, but there has been a historic policy decision that there's benefit in having a diversity of residence mix, and that's partly because for those residents who don't have dementia, for those residents who are experiencing the onset of dementia, there's really a quality of life benefit in terms of having that diversity of residence. That quality of life benefit happens to correspond to a financial benefit for the state. So I think in terms of meeting the home's historic mission of being a respectful and supportive final home for elders, having that diversity of residents, including some level one and level two, is actually very consistent with the home's historic mission.
Follow up. And I'm very sensitive to the fact that we're talking about our neighbors and our fellow human beings that are in need here. Somebody has to pay for that. And right now, we're having a conversation in this committee about who's going to pay for that and to how and to what level. And it really is germane to the purpose of the buildings and the structures that exist to take care of people. Does the structure and the intent of the program of the state take into account all things, all levels of care, or does it limit it to those things that we can afford to provide? And unfortunately, a level of care that is not affordable to be subsidized by the state would have to be found elsewhere. That is a legitimate alternative to funding all things for all people.
Madam Chairwoman.
Well, we're not going to get an argument here because it's not. Your statement is correct. It's absolutely correct. Just as we did the operating budget, it is for us to determine as a group of 60 individual legislators to determine where we want funding to go, whether it's in the Pioneer Home, whether it's in education, where it's at. The bill before us is exactly that. We have a policy call being made. Do we want to set rates that we know that everyone who's currently being occupied in the Pioneer Home cannot afford to do? And if this bill moves forward, are we going to subsidize it at this level, or is the subsidy at this point going to be within the operating budget? at this point, unless somebody has a bill before us to change the structure of the Pioneer Home, and those in the Pioneer Home, I'm not suggesting that, but that's what it would take. It would take the legislature to say that this is the way somebody would have to have a bill saying this is how we want the Pioneer Homes to be done, whether that's at all or whether it needs to be done in a different fashion, but that would have to come before us in a different form. For today's discussion is whether or not this piece of legislation is something that has enough support to move out of committee in the current structure that has been written in by Representative Fields.
Madam Chair.
Representative Fields.
If I might, I guess I would just put this bill in the context of the broader discussion around a sustainable budget and healthcare savings that really started with Senate Bill 74. And I think, and through the chair, I think it's important to recognize some of the savings that are associated with the Pioneer Homes. Director Lasley correctly mentioned earlier that when residents are in the Pioneer Homes, they're not at the more expensive nursing home level, which to a large extent is a 50-50 Medicaid match, so we're actually on the hook for that as a state. The Agnew-Beck report looked at nursing home care and estimated the average nursing home care in Anchorage at $20,000 a year, you know, which at 50-50 is $10,000 per year per person from a state obligation. So I think, yes, these are real costs, but it's not like people just disappear if they are in the Pioneer Homes. Some of them are at API for over $500,000 per year. Some of them are at nursing homes. So I guess I would just return to this bill is consistent with the vision under Senate Bill 74 to have a more fiscally conservative healthcare system. And the Pioneer Homes, 451 people really exist within this much broader ecosystem.
But it is policy call, and I think that's what the representative is asking. It absolutely is. And that's a policy call that is made by us as legislators. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair for Mr. Teal. Mr. Teal, am I right that the administration's sort of starting position was that the Pioneer Homes would be a net zero cost to the state, but then the administration from the outset conceded it would need somewhere in the range of $25 million invariably to supplement and help so that people weren't required to leave the Pioneer Home. It made that concession.
Through the chair, I think if you look at it that way, you're looking at it from the single appropriation Pioneer's Home, and you're forgetting to add in the governor's payment assistance allocation. So there was never, well, I can't speak for the governor, but there doesn't appear to be any intent on the part of the governor to have no general fund support. It was 15, then 20, versus the House is $25 million of general fund subsidy.
Follow up?
So to make it absolutely plain, this administration, which is insistent on lots of cuts, and that's great, I'm not complaining about that for purposes of this meeting, it agreed that it had to continue, they can call it payment assistance, but effectively to subsidize the cost of the Pioneer Home.
To the chair, that's correct.
Okay. Follow up?
Follow up?
Although the bill is a long way from becoming a law, which we all know, given that the division doesn't know for sure how much money they can raise that is unutilized and capturable, am I right that given the bill generates more revenue and reduces the expense gap and reflects inflation, which hasn't happened as it should have, perhaps it over-reflects, but that there'd be some merit, that is, if we had a bill signing ceremony here right now, there might be some merit in doing the bill pending completion of obtaining the financial information they don't yet have so that we could have a better sense of what's capturable. Does that make sense?
No.
Doesn't make sense? Let's see if Mr. Teal thinks it makes sense.
It makes sense through the chair. I'd like to sometime have that information, and it makes sense to look at that information. It's just you can't get that information. Because, again, you'd be looking at who are we going to admit next year or the year after that? What level of care? What is their finances? how much is the subsidy going to be? How much is the self-pay? All unanswerable questions.
But I guess what floors me on this is if you want Medicaid or you want food stamps or any of the programs we have, we require a lot of information about need. And I understand that the part that we're talking about are those who don't need any help. And if you don't need any help and you can pay, we shouldn't be getting into anyone's business on that. But I'm not even sure we're getting the proper information for those that we are subsidizing. At least that's what the word I got from Mr. Lastly, and I guess that's part of my uneasiness, is that are we doing our due diligence to make sure we are helping? And Representative Johnston brought some of that up as well. Are we really subsidizing people who need subsidized, or are there people who have money in other places that maybe we just don't know about? But I think with this, the other part is that $25 million. Shouldn't that $25 million be UGF? I mean, putting it into a fund for the purpose of the Pioneer Home, and then call it DGF, why would we not just put $25 million in, or 33, whatever is necessary, versus make a new fund now that will have to be capitalized every year?
Madam Chair, there's no fund created. It is UGF. The money goes there. I think the purpose of a separate appropriation was to make it clearly visible exactly how much the subsidy was. But you don't need that, because all you have to do is look at the Pioneers homes. It costs $61 million to operate them. And $33 million of that is UGF. It's $33 million subsidy. That answer is easy. It's very visible to all, and the structure change, I don't think, makes it any more visible. It just confuses the issue of, oh, so now the Pioneers Homes has to go and get money from a different allocation, and you're going to have money crossing allocation lines. That's a bureaucratic inefficiency. If the money were simply in the Pioneers Homes to begin with, it would go towards the subsidy. Now they're going to have to request a transfer of money from one allocation to another, which I would argue is a very inefficient way to do things. That won't affect the homes and the care there. It's just an administrative issue.
And that bill does not correct that inefficiency, correct?
It does not. The bill retains the structure that the governor proposed.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a lot of work that went into this, and I truly appreciate the thinking that's gone into this. I do also truly believe that we continue to get the cart before the horse here. Maybe Mr. Lastly or somebody could address a question here. Is there a level of care that the Pioneer Homes can provide without subsidy?
Mr. Lastly, could you help Representative Carpenter with this question, please?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I don't believe there is, under the structure of, the Pioneer Home system is developed to be a safety net for those individuals that either the private sector is not providing the service, or there isn't services, or they can't afford services in the private sector. And so the Pioneer Home system has become that safety net for those individuals that need services, and understanding that the state will subsidize the portion that they are unable to pay.
Okay, any further? Representative Carpenter.
Just from what I understand, that doesn't jive with what it originally was the intent, which was a level one care. And so we've grown. We've got the cart before the horse, in the sense that we've grown to a point that we can't afford to be all things to all people. We can't provide all services to all people at the subsidy levels of what we're at right now. And so if we continue to go down this road, the only question we really need to answer is, where are we getting the money from? Is it coming from out of people's pockets, as in need-based, and X number coming out of out of the subsidy. That's all the question that we need to answer right now.
That's it.
Mr. Lastly, if we didn't have the Pioneer Homes, where would these individuals go?
Madam Chair, if we did not have the Pioneer Homes, there isn't enough facilities in the state of Alaska. They would have to go out of state. And, you know, back to Representative Carpenter's point, I mean, we, you know, since the Pioneer Homes inception, there was, so in 1913, Representative Hill is correct, it was just one level of service. But going back all the way to 1954, we had three levels of service. It then jumped up to a five level of service model in 1996, and for some reason back down to a three level in 2004. So, you know, for more than 70 years, we've been providing services at multi levels of care and subsidizing those individuals that need services.
So at the beginning, when they was, can you say for sure, and I'm sure you probably weren't in charge of the Pioneer Homes at that time, that the state at some point did not subsidize the Pioneer Homes? Or did we always play a part in that? Do you have any idea?
From, you know, Madam Chair, through old newspaper articles, I mean, in 1913, whenever CIFCA was established, it was for indigent men, as Representative Phils mentioned. And so, individuals were only paying a portion, you know, very small portion of what it cost for their food and housing and things of that nature.
Okay, and I find it interesting it was men and not women, but I won't drag on that point. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think that just because the original population that tended to use Pioneer Home Services tended to be level one care didn't necessarily make a statement about what the purpose of the Pioneer Home was. It's just that that's what the population was at that time. The population has changed. People are growing older. We have a higher rate of dementia and things like that. So the changes that were made were not like a policy change in that we're now going to try to become all things to all people. It was changes based on the changing population, based on the needs of the changing population. And I just want to add that the mission statement of the Pioneer Home is to assist older Alaskans to have the highest quality of life by providing assisted living in a safe home setting which promotes independence, positive relationships, meaningful activities, physical and emotional and spiritual growth. So that's the mission. So I don't see that there's any, in the changes that have been made, there's been any changes in the mission. It's just adapting to the needs of Alaskans.
So that's a really good point.
Representative Carpenter.
And just direct follow-up here. If we're only talking about assisted living as being the mission of the organization, then when we start talking about stuff that actually strays into nursing home care, which would be our higher level of care, then that is not meeting with the purpose of assisted living. It is a different level of care. It is a different service altogether. It is no longer assisted living. It is nursing home care.
I guess you're assuming.
Representative Ortiz.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just trying to figure out who's in control here.
I guess you're assuming a specific definition of what assisted living means. What assisted living means might be something different to you than to somebody else.
Representative Carpenter.
That is true. I would say that the industry has assisted living homes. They have nursing homes. They have, right? And so I would be, hopefully I would be accurate in saying that my idea is in keeping with what an assisted living home is, and that would be what Pioneer Homes' mission statement is saying, but the service that we are trying to provide to 12 people at level 5 would maybe not be assisted living type service. It would be nursing home service.
Okay, although this is very entertaining, and we're not going to continue it, because otherwise we would have nothing to say tomorrow when HB 96 will be before us again. We do have at least a couple of amendments that have been put forward.
We will discuss those at 1:30 tomorrow with as well HB 102 rental vehicle by private owner. Mr. King will also be back with appropriation limit. He's going to be giving us a comparison of the different ones that are out there. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Representative Josephson.
Just that, as you, the chair, indicated earlier, this debate was interesting, but it's not the bill before us. That's all I was going to say.
The policy call is before us because the fiscal note is for the Pioneer Home. It is a discussion that I believe, as we decide what to do with this bill tomorrow, is very appropriate. But as there are 11 of us who represent 11 different parts of the state, as well as Alaska as a whole, I look forward to more entertainment for this tomorrow. And with that, and Representative Knopp.
So it's an interesting conversation. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carpenter brings up a good point about the level of care in nursing homes, but two things, and while Mr. Teal is here as well, you know, if you change the structure of the level of service that they provide, two things may happen. One is that then people are going to be cared for somewhere, so somebody's going to collect that revenue someplace, and the other point is that if it's got a 471-bed capacity, and you're only providing services for level 3, 4, and 5, say not 1 and 2, you end up with vacancies, which still drives up your cost per member even more so, because you have your fixed costs of maintaining that facility. So as we can continue this conversation tomorrow, that's something you may consider. So.
Sounds very good. I want to also make sure that our pioneers know we believe that they are very important. Please do not take anything we say at heart. We are always struggling with the policy calls of today for the future of tomorrow. So with that said, and seeing no other questions or concerns, it is 3:38, and we're adjourned.